the Japanese mafia isn't hidden, right? I mean, the fact that we have fan magazines, right? You know, until 2018, when they forced one of the last ones out of business. When you know, here's Goro Tadamasa on the cover of the magazine. Here's the number two of the Yamaguchi Gumi on it. I mean, they've got comic books about their lives.
And for clarity, we're talking about organized crime, right? Like we're talking about people who are breaking the law, and they allow that, like consumer facing, like right in your face.
They claim to be humanitarian organizations. The term is Ninkyo Dantai. They claim to be like the Boy Scouts of Japan, preserving traditional values, keeping the peace, giving wayward youth a place to be disciplined, and keeping them in line. And, you know, they have a constitutional right to be together. And so, you know, for many, many years in Japan, it was like, yes, there are a lot of criminals in our group and some bad people, but we keep them in line.
How can I help? How can I be useful in ending needless suffering? Do not be afraid of work that has no end.
We have to organize a social movement.
We have an opportunity to lead by example versus just talking hot air.
I think the more people in this fight, the more we grow. Eventually, you could change. You know, the people are the ones that can make the change.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Season 2 of Change Agents, an Ironclad original, proudly presented by our friends at Montana Knife Company. Today's episode is about organized crime in Japan. And to dive into that topic, we're going to be talking with journalist Jake Adelstein, who wrote about his experiences covering organized crime in Japan in Tokyo Vice, which is actually now a hit show on HBO, and his new book, The Last Yakuza, Life and Death in the Japanese Underworld. For those of you unfamiliar with the Yakuza, they are the Japanese equivalent of gangsters or mobsters, but it wouldn't be a direct parallel to the mob in the United States, and we actually get into that on the episode. The Yakuza reached their peak popularity in Japan in the early 80s with an estimated 185,000 members. Membership has declined substantially since then. However, there are still thought to be about 10,500 members and about 10,000 quasi-members. They control Japan's drug and human trafficking markets and have influence over the banks and housing markets as well. Let's get into the episode. When did you develop an interest in the Yakuza? And it probably would help if you broke down what that organization is as well for the listener.
Sure. First of all, when we say Yakuza, we are using a term that refers to 20 plus different organized crime groups in Japan. The big three being the Yamaguchi Gumi, which was founded in 1915, making them over 100 years old. The Sumiyoshikai, which is based in Tokyo. They have an office in Ginza. If you're shopping in Ginza, you can go knock on their office doors. I wouldn't advise that you do it. I think they're under the name Hama Enterprise, but sometimes they change the name. Then there's the Inagawa Kai, which is based actually in Yokohama, but they have their offices in Roppongi, right across from the Ritz-Carlton. So if you go there on a certain Thursday of the month, you can see them all lining up in their black cars and having meetings. And there'll be a lot of cops out there sort of like watching to see that there's no trouble. The Yamaguchi Gumi has their offices in Kobe. And their offices are like a city block. It's like a huge fortress. You can see it on Google Maps. I've actually been in the compound a couple of times because they used to have a neighborhood Halloween party for the kids, up until 2017, and quite a lavish party, very well liked in their neighborhood. And I knew an Indian family there, and I would pretend to, be the uncle and go with the kids just to observe. And I think at some point they realized that, who I was, but we were all just very nice and polite about it, and, didn't break that fourth wall of like, you're really a reporter. You're not just kid's uncle.
Probably best that you guys kept the fourth wall intact. I would agree.
Yeah.
So when did they first hit your radar? When did you first develop an interest in not only the organization, but a desire to write about them?
Well, I wasn't interested in them, but I was assigned to them. So it wasn't like this. Every reporter in Japan typically starts on the police beat. You get hired, you get sent to a regional office. Everybody's on the police beat, with some exceptions. So the very first year that I was on the job, there was a brewing story about a serial killer husband and wife. They were dog breeders and pet shop owners. And around them for 10 years, 10 people disappeared. And we all knew that the Saitama police were investigating, that this was going to be the top story, because there's not that many serial killers in Japan, and this was such a bizarre case. So everybody got assigned like a victim, like a missing person to follow up on. And I got assigned this Yakuza boss, an underboss named Endo Makoto from the Inagawa Kai, Takaragumi. And my job was to find out when he disappeared, why he might have been killed, you know, find people that when they did find his body or find out what happened to him, could comment for the paper. You know, and so I'm like, okay, I don't know much about the Yakuza, so I better read up a little bit. And I remember the first time, you know, I went to the Takagumi office. I'm like, well, you know, he was a member here. So I'll knock on the door and see, you know, what they can tell me about him, or when was the last time they saw him. And man, that was a terrible mistake, because I knocked on the door and I heard dogs barking and people running, and they chased me down the street. And, you know, I hopped into a taxi and ran away. It wasn't a particularly great moment in my journalism career. But over time, and you know, we spent a lot of time working on this story. It turned out that there was a detective from the organized crime squad who had been sent to the homicide squad to work on this case. So he was kind of an odd man out, because the homicide squad guys are very territorial and very tribal. They don't really like outsiders. They don't really like reporters very much either. But this one guy, Sekiguchi Chiaki, who was living in the area, who knew I think he went to high school with the Yakuza boss. So he also knew the guy who had disappeared, because it was a small town. I, you know, kind of wormed my way into his graces, just like on the TV show. I did bring ice cream to the house after, you know, not failing to meet him many times on a hot summer night. And I was like, here's the ice cream for your kids, because I keep seeing your kids every time I open the door and you tell me your husband isn't home, but you know, it's going to melt, so please enjoy. And then, you know, I heard him from the background. He's like, yeah, come on in. And it came in, I ate ice cream with him and the kids. And that was the beginning of our friendship and mentorship.
Hey guys, my name is Dom Rosso. I'm a Navy Special Operations veteran and owner and founder of the tactical company Crush Everything. I also train people in home defense, combatives, blade work, and advanced firearms training. Now I get to bring my years of experience to people who want answers to the world's most dangerous questions. Each week on my new Ironclad Original, I get to take calls from people about self-defense, my experience in combat, gear, life-threatening scenarios, and other important subjects. I'll also be breaking down real-world footage of violent situations to help you, the viewer, understand what to do when it all goes down. This season, we'll have the opportunity to bring in high-profile guests, host surprise appearances, and do cool giveaways and a whole lot more. Make sure you guys subscribe to Dangerous Questions, an Ironclad Original, on YouTube at This Is Ironclad, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And he was like, you know, as it was working on the story, and I was like, I don't know what I'm doing. He's like, you know, well, you're going to need to understand the Yakuza. And he said, like, fortunately for you, this isn't a secret society. So he gave me a couple books to read. So read this book. Here's a autobiography of one Yakuza boss. It's less bullshit than the others. It's like, here are what the fan magazines look like. Go to a 7-Eleven or a bookstore. You can buy them there. Start reading them, because you'll need to know who's who. And then he also loaned me this huge book called Byori Shudan no Kozo, which is literally the structure of pathologically criminally ill groups. That's this academic text written in the 60s about the Yakuza. But, you know, all of that was very helpful. And so by 1994, after doing some good work on that story about the serial killer who was eventually caught, my boss said to me, it's like, Adelstein, we're moving you up to cover police headquarters in Saitama. You're going to be covering organized crime division 1 and 2. And I was like, you know, I actually wanted to do homicide because that was kind of like the glorious place to be. You know, that was front page news stuff. And I'm like, why am I assigned to cover the Yakuza? And he looked at me and he said, you know, about 30% of the Yakuza are Korean Japanese. They're foreigners. Huh. And there's another part of them that are Burakumin, these outcast class of Japanese people that didn't fit in. And he's like, you know, so if you think about it, 30% of them are foreigners. You're a foreigner. You'll fit right in. And that was the beginning of me being fascinated by the Yakuza, because I had to be. If you go on to talk to the police and you're going to talk to the Yakuza, you have to be able to know the terms. You have to be able to recognize when they're name dropping or you can't do your job.
Totally off topic, but I have to know how that serial killer was able to abscond with a Yakuza or Yakuza underboss. How did he end up getting wrapped up in that whole thing?
So Sekinigen had been killing people, mostly disgruntled customers.
Awesome.
He'd sell people these expensive dogs like Alaskan Malamutes. And he'd tell them, like, you can breed these dogs and make, you know, a ton of money. Because there was a sort of boom in exotic animals. But sometimes he'd sell people like sick dogs, you know, like the dogs were infertile. And they would say, well, you defrauded me. You lied to me. I'm going to go to the police. And he'd say, you know, hey, let's talk this out. And he'd give them like a sports drink to drink. Usually it was Yunkil. Yunkil is like one of these Japanese stamina drinks. And then there would be strychnine in it. Hmm. And they'd die. And then he and his wife would chop the meat off the bodies. They'd feed it to the animals. I don't think we ever wrote in the paper that he fed it to the animals. And then they would take the bones to a place they had up in Guma and pulverize them and burn everything in a steel drum so that there was nothing left behind.
And I'm assuming that's what happened to the underboss as well.
Yeah. So the underboss realized that, you know, and the time, which is really bizarre, is Sekinigen, this pet shop owner, you know, got some favorable coverage from some TV. So he was like a celebrity, right? And he was building this very elaborate new dog kennel, right? You know, he was like a celebrity. You see him on TV, you know, he had this bullshit story about, you know, living in Africa and going on safari and stuff, and people ate it up. But when Endo realized that, you know, Sekine had killed these people, he blackmailed him, and he was blackmailing him for a lot of money. Made himself part owner of the kennel. And Sekine, you know, one day was chatting with Endo and his driver, Wakui-san. So he had this young driver whose parents had sort of entrusted Endo. You know, his parent, Wakui, was like a juvenile delinquent whose parents had literally sort of handed him to Endo, this Yakuza boss, said, like, make my son a man, like, straighten him out, get him off of drugs, make him a good guy. So he was Endo's driver, and Sekinege, both of them, you know, stamina drinks were poisoned and they died. Then he took the bodies, did this, what he always did with the bodies, and chopped them up, and then disposed of them the usual way. When I was working on this story, I heard that from one of the detectives that while the wife was chopping up Endo's body, that she sang this Japanese song called Yosaku. And it's like, Yosaku, kong, kong, kong. And there's like the sound of chopping in the song. And I tried to write that as an article. And you know, my immediate boss was like, you know, I checked this with another detective and they said that's not true. So we can't write it. But it turned out in the trial it was true. She did sing Enka, kind of like Japanese country Western music, and that song, while they were chopping up the body.
I mean, the moral of this story is, if you're going to buy a dog from somebody, keep it at that. Don't accept strange beverages, because this guy certainly had a pattern.
Yeah, don't accept strange beverages. The other thing that was about the strange beverages, Yunkiru is just like, you know, really, you know, best-selling stamina drink. I mean, it has weird stuff in it. It's like Viper tincture and civet mix and stuff.
Oh,
and,
boy.
You know, it has a 3,000, it's like a $30 version, right? You can buy at the supermarket. And while I was working on that story, I called up Sato Seiyaku, the company that makes it. And I said, hey, you know, I need to check to make sure that you have this. What's the highest price of your thing? You know, the price you sell it for. And when I explained why, because I was saying, oh yeah, the serial killer used to give your drink with poison in it to people to kill them. The head was, you know, the person on the phone was absolutely incensed. He was like, are you really going to put our name in the paper? And I'm like, yes.
It's what happened.
That's journalism, right? We put the real name in. I'm sorry, but yes, yours was the one that he would use to, you know, to poison and kill people with. And within a day, the head of that, of Sato Seiyaku came down and he had a talk with me and my boss. And after this long talk, my boss went to another room. He came back and he said, we're not going to name the company in the article. I'm like, you know, I understand that that's the principle, but we're not going to do that. And I said, okay. And then I noticed that 2 weeks later, my boss had a new car, but you know, I can't really say there was a causal connection there.
I'm sure one had nothing to do with the other. Maybe the trunk of the car was full of a lifetime supply of those beverages as well. It's hard to say how these things
hard to say. Out. Hard to say.
How close of a comparison would you say, you know, I think we have a largely U.S. audience and most of them have heard of the mob. How close of a comparison would you say the U.S. mob is to how the Yakuza organization is structured in Japan?
I'd say they're completely different. I'd say because the Japanese mafia isn't hidden, right? I mean, the fact that we have fan magazines, right? You know, until 2018, when they forced one of the last ones out of business. When you know, here's Goro Tadamasa on the cover of the magazine. Here's the number two of the Yamaguchi-gumi on it. I mean, they've got comic books about their lives.
You know, we're talking about organized crime, right? Like we're talking about people who are breaking the law and they allow that, like consumer facing, like right in your face.
Well, you know, this is, they claim to be humanitarian organizations. The term is Ninkyo Dantai. They claim to be like the Boy Scouts of Japan, preserving traditional values, keeping the peace, giving wayward youth a place to be disciplined, and keeping them in line. And, you know, they have a constitutional right to be together. And so, you know, for many, many years in Japan, you know, yes, you know, it was like, yes, there are a lot of criminals in our group and some bad people, but we keep them in line. What is interesting, and one reason that I think the Yakuza were tolerated for so long, is that there are essentially crimes that they don't do. And if you went into Yakuza offices, they have kind of on the wall a list of the things that will get you kicked out of the organization. And you know, it's a low bar, but they are no theft, no robbery, like, you know, no mugging, no using force to actually steal money from people, no sexual assault. Of course, that's not going to go over well with the local populace. Ostensibly no dealing or using in drugs. And the fifth one is no unnecessary contact with the authorities. And so on some level, because they're not stealing, you know, they're not breaking into people's houses and stealing, and they're not going to rob you on the street. They're not going to snatch your purse. They're not going to make you give up their wallet. And since they're running the red light districts behind there, they did sort of keep the peace in a sense. Mm-hmm. You know, there's no street crime around the Yakuza office. No one's going to steal your purse or mug you in an area where the Yakuza had their offices and had their territories in those days, because before the police could get to you, they'd probably get to you.
So they have a list of things that would get you kicked out. What would be hypothetically on the list of things that were okay for them to take part in?
extortion and blackmail were always okay.
Okay.
As Takigaki Satoru-san once said to me, he's a retired Yakuza boss. Who now, you know, writes some interesting books. He was like, yeah, you know, if you're doing something so bad that the Yakuza can blackmail you, then you deserve the punishment you get. And that's social justice. That's not a crime.
I mean, that's some interesting, you know, mental gymnastics and moral gymnastics.
Yes. Racketeering, collecting protection money. It's like, yeah, we provide a service. You know, if you're in our neighborhood and you have trouble with a customer or rowdy youth or person next door is, you know, too loud, we take care of that for you. And in return for that, we ask for a small servicing fee. So some Yakuza groups sort of function like, you know, like low rent security companies. You paid them a monthly fee, and if you needed them, they were there.
How does one join?
It's easy. You just knock on the door, say, I'd like to join.
I'm assuming they have a vetting process. How structured are they as an organization? I mean, I look at, you know, I joined the U.S. military. It's a structured approach. You are going to do A, B, C, and D. It's going to take this long. This is the largely the baseline product that you'll get at the end of that pipeline. I'm curious, how does somebody go from A to Z? A being, you know, outside of the door, getting ready to knock, and Z is you're part of the organization.
It's very militaristic and it's very structured. So you basically join. You say you want to join. And unless you're bringing something to the table, let's say you're a biker gang and you're the head of the gang, and you've proven yourself and you already have a revenue stream, you might be able to join at kind of like an officer level, like you'd gone to West Point. You know, you have something to show for yourself.
ROTC, if you will. You've already gone to college.
ROTC, yeah. You've clearly established yourself in the underworld as a force. I think this is plugging my own book here, but so this is the last Yakuza, right? And the protagonist of this book was unusual in that his path up was like he was running a sort of right-wing organization, shaking down people in his neighborhood, and it already sort of established people were racketeering to him. And when the local Yakuza group was like, you know, you are infringing on our territory, and basically beat the crap out of him and dissolved his group, he decided that he would join the Inagawa Kai, which also had territory there. And they're like, okay, you know, you have men and you have organizations, so you get to join at an executive level. You're not going to have to do the usual grind. The usual grind is when you join the Yakuza, you spend a year living in the office. Like, and you spend a year living in the office. You know, they give you a place to, you know, they give you an allowance. And then your job is to answer the phone, to cook food for the boss, to follow him around, to learn the, you know, the decorum and the basics and the rituals of Yakuza life so that you can fit in. And then after your year or so, you know, then they start letting you do tasks like collect interest on loans, maybe evict people from their homes, and they establish yourself. Then you get, sort of get to go out in the world and, you know, earn money and pay your association dues. That's the classic, you know, from the bottom up of the Yakuza world. There are risks too, and there are ways to move up quickly. One is if there's a gang war in the old days and you go put your life on the line or you go shoot up the enemy and you go to jail, when you get out, you get a promotion and you get back pay for the time that you've been in jail. And one of the strong parts of the Yakuza, and you know, that system has sort of faded away, is if you go to jail for the organization, they look after your family. And, you know, not just your family. If you're married, they'll look after your wife and make sure that she's taken care of. And they'll also look after your mistress, because they understand that both of those are important parts of your life.
They're very inclusive. They have a DEI initiative, I can tell.
Very inclusive. They are very sexist, because there's only been maybe one or two female Yakuza in the entire history of the organizations. But
were they successful inside of that organization, or they just happened to be a part of it? Were they able to like rise to the top, or just kind of mid-level?
You know, there was one woman in the Yamaguchi-gumi who had a small organization, was fairly successful, but never rose to, like, you know, most groups have a first, second, third tier. I think she was on the fourth tier, but, you know, she had her turf and her territory and she was respected. So, you know, it's very rare. I mean, it's a very sexist society. It's sort of set up like this nuclear family where you have the Oyabun, that's the father. Everybody under him is the Kobun, the children. And then you've got older brother and younger brother And then you have, you know, just the low level brothers.
The low level brothers. Man, that would suck to be born into that tier.
You can work your way up,
I guess. Ladies and gentlemen, today's episode is also brought to you by Mountain Tough. It's a unique functional fitness program that is, of course, supported by hunters and SEALs and Rangers and those from the special operations community. But that is not my favorite part of the Mountain Tough system or program. Although it was developed with insights from the backcountry hunter and veteran special operations community, there is an emphasis on more than just physical strength, which I believe to be essential. It is also about building an unbreakable mind. It is easy to build muscles from the neck down. It is far more difficult to build muscles from the neck up and the resilience between your ears. The Mountain Tough app provides the best functional fitness program directly to your phone, tablet, TV, or a web browser. So you really don't have an excuse to say, oh, I didn't know what I could be doing or should be doing, whether it's a program or inspiration or insight. It's all right there at the touch of your fingers. Some of you might be saying, well, I'm not a ex-special operations personnel. I'm also not a backcountry hunter. That's okay. For those of you who might not start out as an elite athlete, but you want to improve wherever you may be, Mountain Tough is determined to push everybody's limits. And they're going to meet you where you are with thoughtful programming, helping you achieve elite status through progressive fitness, focusing on longevity, injury prevention, and holistic development. It's a story arc from wherever you are, getting as close to elite as could possibly be. So what are you waiting for? You can join the global Mountain Tough community right now. A community of people transforming their lives, bodies, and minds. Download the Mountain Tough app today and start training to always be ready for whatever it is you're trying to be ready for the backcountry, for the mission, or just life's unexpected challenges. Because when it comes to being prepared, there's no excuse to not start now. You can use the code CHANGE, which I'm looking at all capital letters, one word, at mountaintough.com on the monthly plan to get your first month absolutely free after your 14-day free trial. That's 6 weeks free to dive in, test the waters, the programming, and make sure it's actually for you. What are you waiting for? You can change your life today, be ready for the mountains, the mission, and just life in general. I hope you are enjoying season two of Change Agents, which is an Ironclad original. And if you are a fan of the podcast, you know that we are presented by Montana Knife Company, which from where I am sitting right now is a short 2-hour drive, maybe 120 miles due south towards Missoula. I was first exposed to this brand through its founder, Josh Smith. And actually, when I first met him, I wasn't even aware of what Montana Knife Company was. He sat across the table from me. We had a conversation. And I have been a fan ever since. This was a few years ago, and the velocity and trajectory of that company is unbelievable. I directly associate that growth with who Josh is, what he stands for, and what he puts into his product. So a little bit more about Josh. He's been making knives for 30 years. They're made in the USA. They have a multi-generational warranty and free sharpening. They're designed, tested, and they're built by hunters, and MKC's a hunting knife company first and foremost. They sell out their knives sometimes in under 60 seconds. And if you want to see what they have available or what's coming up, surf over to MontanaKnifeCompany.com. They have a new knife drop every Thursday at 7 p.m. Here's what I'm going to say on that. Practice checking out. As ridiculous as that sounds, you need to have your credit card information loaded and practice the checkout process, because they go like that. I cannot even count the number of times I have had a knife taken from my cart because somebody was faster to purchase it than I was. People ask me all the time, what's my favorite blade of theirs? I go with the Mini Speed Go. It is my everyday carry knife. I don't use it for knife fighting. I use it for things that I need a knife for, so usually opening boxes. But it is my favorite blade, and if you're a fan of working knives made for working people, I highly suggest that you check out Montana Knife Company. And I'm going to add to that. Let's talk a little bit about the warranty. They have the best warranty program in the industry. No matter if you bought the knife from them directly, or bought the knife from a friend, or it was gifted to you, or if you even found the knife, they're going to honor the warranty for the life of the blade. How awesome is that? Couldn't be more proud to have them as the presenting sponsor of Change Agents. They are a fantastic organization. So what are they expected to learn? You were saying in that year they're living in the office, you know, they're kind of learning the ethics, they're learning the rituals. What kind of, when you say rituals and ethics, what do you mean by that? Other than obviously the things that are on the wall, the things you can get fired for. Is there an internal code that they live by, like a dress, a speech, behavior pattern?
You know, it varies from group to group, but in the Inagaokai, you're expected to learn to dress nicely, you know, like polish your shoes, have a nice tie, you know, wear a suit right, walk behind your boss, you know, three steps, to be able to speak to people in proper, polite Japanese. A lot of these people are like juvenile delinquents, right? So like, okay, you know, of course you need to be menacing, but you also need to be within the organization, deferential to the people above you, and you need to be able to speak polite, standard Japanese in the situations that require. And then you also need to know who's who. You know, it's a lot of it is also learning like, okay, who has to be treated with deference, who doesn't have to be treated with deference, what companies do we own, what companies, you know, are paying us money, what companies are we running, who are our corporate blood brothers. You need to know everybody's face and name.
How does the government treat this organization? And then the follow-up to that would be, how does the average citizen view that organization as well?
I would say for, you know, when I started in 1993 as a reporter, they had just put the first organized crime laws on the books, the Boryukudan Taisakuho. And the irony of the new laws, and they were such weak laws, were that, you know, you basically got a warning from the cops. If you, you know, if you were shaking down someone, you were asking for, if you were asking the locals to pay you money or buy products from you, you'd got a warning, and then the next you would get a cease and desist order. And then if you did it a third time, then you were get a criminal penalty. So for the Yakuza, you know, and also you weren't allowed to put your colors on the door anymore. You couldn't just have a Yakuza office with your emblem on it. You had to, you know, you had to put that away. That was a violation. So everybody started creating front companies. Takada Gumi became Takada Enterprise. You know, the Sumiyoshikai became Hama Enterprise. Inagawa Kai, you know, I think had buildings like Inagawa Kogyo. You know, these laws that went on the books were a boon for the Yakuza, because like, okay, we can, you know, keep squeezing money out of this person until we get the Chuchimire, and then we'll stop, and then we won't get arrested. So it's kind of like, you know, all right, you know, we can take this so far, and then before you get arrested, you know, you're like, all right, you know, next time we're going to get arrested, so we'll stop. And yeah, I don't think that was particularly effective.
It almost sounds like they wrote their playbook for them a little bit, or at least give them, in the world I come from, we'd call it the ROEs, the rules of engagement. Like, okay, we'll go right up to the edge of that. Any further, we're outside of those, and we'll probably get additional scrutiny. So if we stay inside of that, we're good to go.
Yeah. So yeah, there was at least an ROE established. But, you know, but if you look what happened, like, you know, the number of Yakuza were 80,000 in 1992, stayed 80,000, you know, up to about 2011. Eventually, the Yakuza got so out of hand, in many ways, infiltrating the stock market, they began to threaten the police officers that were investigating them. And that was a big no-no. I mean, you know, there was a kind of live and let live. You didn't threaten officers, right? That was a bad one. And that was the Yamaguchi Mikodokai that started buying the phone numbers of Yakuza, of the detectives working the cases, and then, you know, doing things like during interrogation, they'd say like, oh, you know, detective, you know, Sekiguchi-san, you know, it's 5 o'clock. Shouldn't you be home for your daughter's birthday?
Oof.
You know, that went over very badly. I think that's probably what really got the cops to crack down on them. So by 2011, October 1st, 2011, it took a 2-year process, sort of coordinated by the National Police Agency behind the back of the National Diet. Every prefecture in Japan put on the books an anti-organized crime ordinance. And ordinances are very weak laws, but they are effective. And what they basically say is, if you do business with the Yakuza, if you profit with them, then you are a criminal and you will be punished. And that became very, very effective in, you know, crapping down on the Yakuza. And at the same time, all of this was also, you know, one guy thought of this whole structure. It was Igari Toshiro, used to be my lawyer. He was the first person to come up with the idea of putting a exclusionary clause in contracts that, you know, basically said in the contract, you know, every contract you can sign in Japan now has this, is you have to sign a statement that is, I am not a member of an organized crime group, nor I am associated with them. But if you sign that and you are, then you can be arrested for fraud. Then the cops can come and arrest you and hold you in jail for 23 days. And a lot of the time you get prosecuted for it. So by 2011, not only do you have these laws for making it a criminal act to pay off the Yakuza or work with them, almost everything in Japan now had this contract embedded. So if you're a Yakuza, you cannot easily get a cell phone, rent an apartment, open a bank account. You know, starting from 2011, they started going to Yakuza who had bank accounts and said, like, you know, well, we need you to renew your contract. And they'd send them the new contract, which would be like, you have to have that box to check. They couldn't check it. Then they lose their bank accounts.
What would you estimate their size at now in 2024?
Official estimates are about 24,000. So okay. If you consider that in 2011, yeah, 24,000. That's a quarter of what they were.
What an interesting approach, too. It's a non-direct approach. You're coming at it from a different angle and squeezing the organization, but from the outside, as opposed to applying direct pressure to them. And I mean, obviously, the numbers speak for themselves, though. That's I like that approach to it, actually. It's a little bit more non-direct, probably a little bit better than doing a SWAT team takedown of the organization.
Yeah. where that didn't work very well is in Kyushu, where the Kudokai has their offices, because they were like, you know, they were blowing up, they threw a grenade into a hostess club that wouldn't pay them protection money, burned down buildings, killed people. They were not going gently into that good night. I think about 2 or 3 years ago, the head of that organization and his number two were arrested and charged with multiple counts of murder and attempted murder and given the death penalty. Are given the death penalty. I don't think they've been executed yet because they're still in appeals.
Wow. Do you ever worry about your own personal safety reporting on organizations like this? I can't imagine that they, well, I guess it could be a double-edged sword. You know, there's, you know, the saying, all press is good press. But at the same time, you know, I would imagine if you're uncovering or talking about the kind of the seedy underbelly of their actions, that an organization may not exactly want that consumer facing.
You know, I had a couple times that I felt like, okay, I'm in a little danger here. I think the first time was I was writing about a Korean savings and loan that had been looted by the Yakuza and was going to go under in Saitama. And I got, you know, threatening phone calls and weird people showing up in front of my house. And the response of the Yomiuri Shimbun and the number two in the National News Department was they moved me out of Saitama. It's like, okay, you know, great job, great work. We're taking you up to Tokyo, where you're far from these people that want to kill you. And I'm like, thanks, that's appreciated. And then, you know, through dogged persistence, I was onto this great story about a Yakuza boss named Goto Tadamasa, who made a deal with the FBI to get into the United States to get a liver transplant. And then there were three other Yakuza who also got a liver transplant at UCLA. And as I was writing and working on that piece, it came to his attention. And then it came to the police that it had come to his attention. And so I was put under police protection for about 5 years.
Why would the FBI do that? I was going to ask you about that. So you wrote about that in your book, Tokyo Vice.
So I don't blame the FBI for doing it, because here's the deal. You know, the Yakuza, this, you know, we talk about the glamorous parts, you know, and the fights and stuff, but I mean, they're terrible parasites. They run loan sharking operations, human trafficking, a lot of drug dealing, and a lot of dirty money being put into the United States. money laundering. The problem is that the Japanese police would not share that information with the U.S. authorities. Like, absolutely not. You know, and to track the Yakuza in and out of the United States, you need to know their names, their date of birth. You have to have the kanji. Because let me tell you, you know, if I know someone is named Tanaka Taro or Yamamoto Akira, there's hundreds of ways that that name could be used. Like, there's thousands of people with the exact same name pronunciation. If I don't know the Japanese characters and the date of birth, I cannot track that person when they're going into the United States.
Why would the Japanese authorities be unwilling to share the information about those criminals?
Well, there's two theories. One is that they're corrupt. And the second is that the kind of that information about who's in the Yakuza is very valuable when you leave the police and are looking for a retirement position, right? Mm. But if everybody has that information, then it's not exclusive, and then it's no use to you. The third is that, you know, even Yakuza have personal privacy, which must be protected.
Okay, again, some mental gymnastics going on.
but the U.S. was very frustrated that the Japanese wouldn't share it with them. And so when Tadamasu Goto, who was, you know, dying of a bad liver, approached the FBI at the embassy through a politician in the Liberal Democratic Party, and said, you know, I will give you, you know, names and numbers and, you know, our front companies, our operations in the United States, you know, a list of everyone in our organization and their dates of birth and their kanji, so that you can keep track of them. And all I want is a visa into the United States. And he knew that he wouldn't be able to get into the United States under his own name and his own passport. Because a couple of years prior to him, another Yakuza boss named Takumi Masaru had tried to go to France to get a liver transplant and had been rejected at the border. And, you know, he had already made arrangements to get the surgery done at UCLA. The United States didn't have any part in that. Nor did they have any part in the other three Yakuza lowlifes who managed to get a liver transplant at UCLA. But Goto knew that he was high marked and he needed a visa to get there to get the liver transplant, and the FBI facilitated that. And he did give them some information, but as soon as he got his liver, which was very fast, I think I posted on Twitter the UCLA's internal investigation into how these four Yakuza got liver transplants. I've never seen so much bullshit in my life. You know, I mean, I'm not a doctor, but I've spent enough time on researching this stuff and showing it to people. It's like, yeah, it doesn't make any sense what you're saying about why these guys, you know, got to the top of the line to get their liver transplants. Anyway, it made sense. The bad part of this is that he totally screwed them, because he gave them a bunch of stuff up front. But once he got his liver, he vanished. I think he went to Hawaii and play golf, and he never gave them the rest of the information. Jim Stern, who is a former special agent, probably the only Jewish Japanese special agent that has ever been in the FBI. I think I wrote a little very short, long article about him called Operation Tropical Storm. He said these great words. He said, you know, getting the information first is informant 101. They should have dangled the liver in front of him and said, tell us everything you know, or we're feeding it to the dogs. But they didn't do that. And he really screwed them. So that's the bad part of it. The FBI got some intelligence, but they got, a fifth of what they were promised.
That's why you fill the paperwork out before they give you the car keys at a new dealership as well. You know, it's, you don't get the car and get to drive off and, hey, come back in a week and we'll settle all this up. Like, the T's are crossed, the I's are dotted, probably for a reason.
Yeah, well, it was poorly handled. And so, so a few years later, another Yakuza boss in the Inagawa-kai went to the U.S. Embassy and was pleading for a visa to go to the United States and get a liver transplant. And the special agent in charge told him, we're not going to let this, you know, it doesn't matter what you offer us, unless you offer us everything up front, and then we'll think about it. And if you want to know why we're saying no, go talk to Goto Taramasa.
Hey guys, my name is Dom Rosso. I'm a Navy Special Operations veteran and owner and founder of the tactical company Crush Everything. I also train people in home defense, combatives, blade work, and advanced firearms training. Now I get to bring my years of experience to people who want answers to the world's most dangerous questions. Each week on my new Ironclad Original, I get to take calls from people about self-defense, my experience in combat, gear, life-threatening scenarios, and other important subjects. I'll also be breaking down real-world footage of violent situations to help you, the viewer, understand what to do when it all goes down. This season, we'll have the opportunity to bring in high-profile guests, host surprise appearances, and do cool giveaways and a whole lot more. Make sure you guys subscribe to Dangerous Questions, an Ironclad Original, on YouTube at This Is Ironclad, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Why were they all needing livers? Is there a... It seems, I don't know if that's the most common organ to fail in the human body, but a little bit uncanny that all of them needed livers?
Well, you know, three things. A lot of them drink heavily. I mean, really drink heavily. The second is a lot of them did methamphetamines when they're young with needles that were not clean. So if you get hepatitis C, which is a very common thing you get from dirty needles, your livers are going to get bad. Hepatitis C test, you know, does great damage to your liver. And the third one is that the traditional tattoos, you know, not these wimpy ones that are done with electronic needles, but the ones where they actually dig into your skin with an awl and put in basically charcoal to fill it. It is so bad for your skin. I mean, the skin dies. Your sweat cells die. That you're really, it's really hard on your body because you're not able to sweat out toxins. God, I don't know how to say this without sounding like a cad. So briefly, I was sleeping with at the time I was sleeping with her, I think her Yakuza lover was already dead, but you know, she had the traditional tattoo, which he paid for and got to her. And, you know, it was like touching a snake in the summer because the skin was so cold.
Wow.
Which is nice in the summer, not so nice in the winter, but you know, it was like, I was kind of like, what's going on there?
So are tattoos a requirement in that organization as well? Or is it more of like a visual representation that you're a part of it?
So tattoos aren't required, but it shows things. In the Inagawa Kai, they call them gaman. Gaman means endurance, you know. So it shows that you can endure pain. It shows that you are incredibly patient because it takes a long time to get those tattoos done. Mm-hmm. It also shows that you have money because they're expensive. And often in the old days, your boss would pay for the tattoo. So you have the organization's emblem and your boss's name engraved on your body. I mean, that's corporate branding at its finest. You know, if you have the Inagawa Kai tattooed on your chest and your boss's name, it makes it very hard to go to another organization. You know, that's like a contract for life.
Yeah, you're kind of a company man at that point for sure.
And it also symbolizes like I have left the life of the straight person, Katagi. I'm no longer Katagi. I am part of this world. I'm committed to this world. So those are the functions it serves.
What about cutting off their pinky finger? Is this a part of the organization as well?
So I think there's a misunderstanding that, you know, you like whenever you leave the Yakuza, you have to cut off your finger. And you don't have to cut off your finger to leave the Yakuza. Just stop paying your association dues and they'll kick you out really easy. Like, oh, I'm not paid. Oh, you haven't paid in like months. You're out. So there's two kinds of reasons that people screw up. And there's different terminologies for the severed finger depending upon it. If one of your underlings fucks up so badly that, you know, that the boss wants to kill him or they want to kick him out of the organization and you chop off your finger and, you know, wrap it up and you give it to the boss and say, I'm terribly sorry for what my underling has done. Please forgive him. That is considered an incredibly honorable thing. And that is called an ikkyubi, like a living finger. And if you've screwed up and you're in a bad situation, you're facing either, you know, terrible punishment or being expelled from the organization, and you chop off your little finger and give it to the boss and it's accepted, then that's called a shinyubi, like a dead finger. And, you know, obviously you can't tell by someone's, you know, finger, like, you know, which is it, an ikkyubi or a shinyubi? But, you know, in the world that is Yakuza, you know, that is, you know, Yakuza junior high school, everybody knows. Everybody. I mean, here's a bizarre thing. You've got like all these different groups in the Yakuza. You've got the Matsuba Kai, you've got the Inagawa Kai, you've got the Yamaguchi-gumi, the Sumiyoshi Kai. Technically, right, they should be fighting over turf and territory. But these guys form brother relationships, cross organizations, and then they send each other like New Year's cards you know, at their homes. You know, so it's, you know, so there's, a, you know, there's a great deal of mixing with everybody. You know, when a big Yakuza boss dies, people from the other organizations come to the funeral. So, you know, everybody knows everything about everybody. And so the, you know, the finger cutting thing, of course, tells people that you are a Yakuza. There's one advantage to it, is that it's really easy to park in the handicap space.
True.
I had a driver who was an ex-Yakuza, and you know, whenever he parked in the handicap space, only once someone gave us some flack about it, he just showed him his finger, and they were like, "Oh, okay, there you go."
I guess that's a creative solution to a commonly faced problem. So, okay, that's a glass half full mentality for sure.
Yeah.
So it sounds like after you wrote Tokyo Vice, you've gotten more involved in covering human trafficking, and I'm curious how you have seen human trafficking expressed in Japan, you know, misconceptions that people might have about it versus the reality that you've actually seen.
The thing about Japan, even when I was a reporter still writing about this, is that Japan has a very legal sex industry. Every single act that you would want to purchase or sell, except vaginal penetration, according to the law, is legally available. So, I mean, it can be advertised, mm-hmm. And it is advertised. Even actual sexual intercourse, depending upon where the establishment is and the zoning laws, can be legal. And there's a workaround for that as well. So what I didn't realize, and I don't think a lot of police realized, is that, you know, foreign women could be easily coerced into doing this job, because sex work is never legal on a visa. You can't be a sex worker, you're violating your visa. So people who are brought here under false pretenses and essentially enslaved, if they went to the police, they just got arrested for overstaying their visa or working off of their visa, and none of the criminals doing it could be touched. So for many years in Japan was a huge destination country, and it was a huge country facilitating human trafficking, because there were no laws in place to protect the women who were being trafficked. And human trafficking was a big deal because it's profitable. I mean, I'll break it down to you in like the simplest terms. And the market at the time was, the whiter the woman was, the more she's worth, because she's more exotic. So let's say you bring in one Estonian woman and you're working her as a prostitute. Of course, you're not paying her because you have her passport, and maybe you're threatening her family back home. You're maybe giving her subsistence living. And she's watched all the time. She's going to bring in at least, $1,000 a night, you know, maybe more. But say, what's a minimum? Let's do the bare minimum. It's $1,000. You would say you work her 22 days a month. That's 22,000, right? Now you get 10 women working for you. Now you're making $220,000 a month. Yeah. What is your overhead? Your overhead is maybe the plane tickets, and you earn all that back in probably first month. So it's an incredibly profitable business. And I think, you know, I think another misconception is that there were people coming here who obviously knew that they were going to be doing sex work, but it doesn't make them any less of a victim if they are not getting paid, and they are not allowed to say no to who they sleep with or who they're going to have sex with. So that's the biggest, I think one of the biggest misconceptions is that, you know, that you're a victim of human trafficking has to be unaware and coerced or not know what's going on for them to be a victim. Japan basically dealt with human trafficking. And after the Second World War, it was very common for families to basically sell their daughters to brothels to have enough money to eat. And then the daughter would have to work off the debt. And then, you know, by the 1950s, as you had female politicians join the National Diet, they basically had a sit out that created the current prostitution laws. And the prostitution laws are designed like this. You cannot arrest the person prostituting themselves, male or female, or the customer, but you can arrest the brothel owner or the pimp. And the reason that was designed is that so that if you were a guy and you went to a place and you realize the woman there is sexually enslaved, she doesn't want to be there, she's miserable, she's not being paid, you could go to the police and say, hey, you know, this person is being treated terribly. And the cops would be like, hey, thank you for the tip. And then they would bust the pimp and she would go free. Except that wasn't the case for foreign women.
Yeah. Has Japan always had a legal and open sex trade?
Yeah, you could almost say it's like Japanese tradition, man.
Huh.
I mean, you know, I mean, I covered Vice, right? So none of this is shocking to me. I'm just kind of numb to it. But it's like, okay, you can't sell vaginal penetration legally as a service, but, you know, anal sex is fine. You can put that on the menu. You know, blowjob, hand, everything else, totally legal.
Okay. I mean, yeah, I guess to each their own. Not my cup of tea for sure. I don't want to run over our time too much here, but I definitely wanted to tell me about your podcast and people purposefully disappearing in Japan. I mean, they're tied, but I'll let you explain it.
You know, Japan is a high pressure society, and it's still a shame society. And I think that when people are really ashamed of where they are in life, or they're heavily in debt, they consider two things. They consider suicide, or they consider disappearing. And often, if you look on websites for, because Japan is a country that loves manuals, you will find the manual of suicide and the manual of disappearance sold together as like, you know, a set. And it's basically like, well, are you going to kill yourself or are you going to vanish and start again? And I would say that vanishing is always the braver choice. One thing, though, that incentivizes suicide here is until recently, for many years, if you killed yourself, there was a huge life insurance payout.
Oh, interesting.
Because that's not necessarily something that stops a life insurance payment. That was also used by the Yakuza to collect money on loans from loan sharks. They would have people sign these contracts when they took out a loan and then goad them into killing themselves if they couldn't pay, which is one reason now I think that it takes 3 years before there's a payout for suicide to sort of prevent that from happening.
So when you're saying people are intentionally disappearing, are they leaving Japan or is this just
they don't leave Japan. There's many ways to become someone else in this country. I mean, you can disappear to some, obscure part of the country and work being paid cash or under the table. Or you can do things like get adopted by an older person. Which it's a system that Japan has in place so that like famous families, like the Toyota family. Let's say, Bucky Toyota doesn't produce any offspring, but you want the Toyota name to live on. So, he could adopt someone else. You know, it's like a company employee as his son, and then the name lives on. And that system can also be used to abandon your last name so that you start life with a new name. And this is handy to you if you need to escape debts or you're a criminal whose exploits have been written up in the paper and you would like, not to signal to the next sucker that you're defrauding that you are a criminal. It's also possible to buy people's family registration. You know, the family registration does not have any photo ID on it. So if you can find someone who's homeless, who's willing to give you their family registration, you can assume their identity. You can get registered. Then you go down to City Hall and you register as a resident of that area under their name. You get a health insurance card, which also does not have a photo on it. And you are on your way to creating a new identity.
I see some flaws in the Japanese system. A picture would be a good start.
the Japanese government is really trying to push kind of a national ID, which will have a photo on it that will link everything together. Your transit card, your health insurance card, so that, you know, it is impossible to disappear, but they're not being very successful so far.
Yeah. Jake, to be respectful of your time, what would you, what else would you like people to know? What would you want to close out with?
I'd like people to know that the next thing I'm working on has nothing to do with Japan, but it has everything to do with a series of murders at the Harry S. Truman Hospital in 1992. Now, my father is still working at the Harry S. Truman Hospital as a chief of pathology and also as the medical examiner at 87. But in 1992, there were about 40 people that died on Ward 4 East. They were all being treated by the same male nurse, and the VA hospital, instead of properly investigating it, tried to cover it up. And then the nurse went on to a nursing home where he probably killed another 30 people. And this podcast is examining why it happened, why the VA tried to cover it up, and what eventually happened to the nurse, which is surprising because he's not in jail.
Come on.
Yeah. I think if you have, you know, the veterans hospitals are really good. I mean, my father is very proud to work in a veterans hospital. I think it is, you know, the only socialized medicine we have in the United States, and they do a very good job. But it's kind of appalling when the VA, which is supposed to take care of the people who put their lives on the line for the United States, get killed there. That's not how it's supposed to work. And even though it's been more than 30 years since this case happened, we felt that it was worth looking at it again.
Where would you point people towards if they're interested in what they heard in today's episode, they would want to learn more? Any references and resources? Obviously your books, right? Tokyo Vice, The Last Yakuza. What else would you recommend?
I've got a new book coming out this summer. Oh, did I even bring it up here? Voila. Tokyo Noir.
Tokyo Noir. What do you got there? A little galley copy?
Yeah, this is my galley copy. It just came yesterday. Very excited.
Awesome. Congrats, man.
Yeah, and the podcast, The Evaporated, or you can find me on Twitter under Jake Adelstein. Very easy.
Awesome. Well, thank you for your time, Jake. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you want to learn more about this issue, or Japan in general, and the role that the Yakuza plays, you can read Jake's books, Tokyo Vice and The Last Yakuza. Thank you again for listening to Change Agents, an Ironclad original presented by Montana Knife Company. We're going to be back next week, as usual, with an all-new episode.